True crime horror story contains extreme violence and adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm your host, JD Horror, and this is True Crime Horror Story, Season 1, Episode 10, Sexual Sadists Part 2, Deadly Duos. If you were a curious teenager growing up in the golden age of the dial-up modem, it didn't take you long to realize that the internet had a much darker side than casual browsing and gaming. The mid to late 90s led to the rise of sites like Rotten.com and The Style Project, that feature graphic gore content like car accidents and executions. As a lonely preteen with way too much time on my hands and a lack of supervision, I stumbled upon the internet's darkest corner and, while in shock, clicked through article after article of horrible things being done by horrible people. Though I was disgusted, I couldn't look away. Eventually, as the internet expanded from slow dial-up connections to videos being able to stream in the time it takes to click your mouse, the sheer number of horrifying images and videos available on demand made it so by the time I graduated high school, nothing was shocking anymore. Rotten has since ceased to exist, and the Style Project has degenerated into nothing but one of the millions of porn sites found online. Though I was able to delete the mental images of much of the filth my young brain inappropriately consumed, a series of a dozen pictures still haunts me to this day. Listeners, this is going to be a rough episode to get through. If you couldn't finish Sexual Sadists Part 1 back in Episode 7 because of the graphic content, I would suggest getting out while you still can, because by the end of this episode, your mind will have sank deep into an endless sea of depravity, and it may never be the same. You've been warned. Part 1. Grotesque. Just before midnight on July 14th, 1982, 33-year-old Robert Bekowitz was sitting on the couch with his 21-year-old girlfriend, Janine Clark, and enjoying the Benny Hill show, when slowly a shadow approached behind him, illuminated only by the light of the cathode ray tube as the English slapstick comedy sketches played out. That shadow was 37-year-old James Glover. Glover hobbled over with his cane in one hand and a gun in the other. The much smaller and partially disabled due to spinal injury Glover had to have the element of surprise. After all, Robert Bekowitz was 6'4" and 250 pounds, and had the full use of his legs. In addition to the stealth factor, Glover had the ultimate equalizer in the form of a .45. Bekowitz never saw it coming. As James Glover placed the pistol to the back of Bekowitz's head, he didn't delay in pulling the trigger. Glover and Clark had been carrying on an affair, and with Bekowitz out of the way, they were now free to carry out their deepest and darkest fantasies, and for a period of 3 days, that is exactly what they did. The body of Robert Bekowitz was placed on a sofa and posed for a picture, while a buck-naked Janine Clark began to cut off his penis with a kitchen knife, stopping to smile for the camera in one of the most disturbing images ever captured on film. Glover and Clark then moved the body to the kitchen, where this time, it was Glover's turn to pose. Bekowitz's corpse was placed onto a pile of scrap wood, as to not damage the shitty linoleum floor during his dismemberment. Before James Glover set down his cane, and slowly and painfully descended onto the linoleum floor to begin the task, he placed a small yellow towel on the floor to sit on. After all, he was naked, except for a pair of tube socks. After the body was in position, Clark tossed her former boyfriend's severed penis over to Glover. Then, she began to snap photo after photo as Glover shoved the strayed genitalia in and out of its owner's own mouth in some form of forced necrophiliac masturbation. The two giggled as they exchanged the camera. Clark picked up a hacksaw and began to slowly saw at her former lover's neck until she met bone. Beckowitz's head flapped back and forth like a macabre version of one of those little Pez candy dispensers. It was held onto his body only by the bone, which she was not strong enough to saw all the way through. Glover snapped photo after photo of the disgusting decapitation attempt, and when he knew she would not be able to complete the task, he took over. Sawing through the remaining muscle and bone with a smile on his face, James Glover removed the head of Robert Beckowitz. He raised the severed trophy high into the air like some sort of tribal warrior of a past era, displaying his human sacrifice to an ancient god. He then tossed it onto the kitchen floor and started to dismember the man limb by limb. Jeanine folded a handmade quilt, most likely carefully constructed by someone's grandmother who had never intended it to be used for such grim purposes, and placed it onto the dining room chair. Glover lowered Beckowitz's head onto the quilt, and the two began to take a series of sophomoric photographs. The disgusting images featured Beckowitz's own severed hand picking his nose. Another featured his amputated foot with his big toe firmly placed in the unfortunate owner's mouth. And of course, they went back to their initial idea of the insentient self-blowjob, which never ceased to fascinate the pair. They then placed the man's severed feet on a small green ottoman in the living room, where they had been propped up for so many nights as Robert had been watching TV. The feet sat there unimpressed, with a rerun of All in the Family playing in the background. Their owner had always hated that show. Glover and Clark fucked multiple times during this revolting period, often incorporating pieces of Beckowitz into their sex acts, all while staying in a drug-induced haze courtesy of the combination of methamphetamine and opiates. No perverse fantasy was left unfulfilled. Clark began to shove pieces of her former boyfriend in and out of her sex, leaving chunks of blood and gore strewn about her massive bush. As Glover leered on, he raped the torso of Beckowitz, aided by a mixture of shit and blood that would serve as lubricant. After a 3.5-day orgy of necrophilia, the drugs were starting to run out and wear off, and Jeanine Clark began to see the gravity of the situation the two had gotten themselves into. It was like she was aboard a child's toy boat, floating in a tub full of blood, but the plug had been pulled, and Jeanine felt herself spiraling down into a drain that would lead directly into a jail cell. Rather than stick by her captain, James Glover, and ride out the shitstorm, she decided to abandon ship. Clark took the stomach-churning photos to Detroit police, claiming she was an unwilling participant who had been forced to commit these atrocities or suffer the same fate as her boyfriend, whom she loved so dearly. However, when the gruesome images were developed, her sinister smile betrayed her, and detectives weren't buying into her bullshit. When police entered the basement apartment on Woodbine Street, they were met with a ghastly sight. The body of Robert Beckowitz had been cut into 14 pieces, wrapped in garbage bags, and hidden all throughout the home. His torso had been stabbed 84 times post-mortem. Blood and viscera trailed from the living room and into the kitchen, back and forth like the pencil marks of a small child who had tried to solve a paper maze that was too complex for their age. James Glover was found in a drug-induced, almost comatose state. He was mostly unresponsive and pled for investigators to just leave him alone as he was dragged away, limping up the basement stairs. Though Jeanine Clark continued to plead her innocence and that she was a victim just like Beckowitz, Janice Mitch, a neighbor of Robert Beckowitz, told police that she saw both Glover and Clark leave the property multiple times in the days following the murder and that Clark did not appear to be held against her will, but was instead seen laughing. The two were even seen perusing two local garage sales on the Saturday that followed the killing, and on another occasion, Clark even left the house by herself to buy more film for the camera. At one point, she was even accidentally locked out of the home and had banged and screamed to be let back in, causing a ruckus that woke up half of the 19,300 block of Woodbine Street. Besides, due to Glover's spinal injury, there was no way he could have committed all the heinous actions on his own. James Glover was immediately arrested, and police were able to arrest Jeanine Clark on a parole violation stemming from a bank robbery she had participated in. Glover pled not guilty to the charges of second-degree murder with the added circumstance of using a firearm and mutilation of a corpse. His defense tried to plead insanity and stated that James was mentally incompetent to stand trial, but a psychiatric evaluation deemed that he was fit to proceed with the trial. Glover limped into the courtroom, heavily leaning on his cane and adorned with a shitty wig in order to hide his tattooed skull. He tried to back up Jeanine's claims that she was coerced into the vile acts, but photographic evidence and testimonies from witnesses that had seen her in the days following the murder told another story. James Glover eventually agreed to change his plea to guilty and was given a 30 to 50 year sentence for his crimes by Judge William Hathaway, an extremely lenient punishment in my humble opinion. Jeanine Clark begged and pleaded for mercy, often crying uncontrollably as she recounted being forced to castrate and mutilate the corpse of Beckowitz. She was charged with the desecration of a corpse, and it only took the jury an hour and 5 minutes to convict her of the crime. Judge Michael Zappala sentenced her to the maximum term allowed, according to Michigan law, a meager 6.5 to 10 years in prison. James Glover still appropriately rots in prison as of this recording. However, Jeanine Clark has been walking free and amongst us for over 20 years, probably with a new identity, perhaps walking into a pharmacy near you to develop some more rolls of film.
Welcome to Haunting History, the podcast that reaches back into the past for the events that shocked us. Tales of true crime, mystery, and the macabre. And when we're lucky, those stories where the past and the paranormal meet. Because who doesn't love a good ghost story, right? I'm your host, Kat.
And I'm Haley. Join us as we discuss and share true accounts from all over Southern California and beyond.
You can find us wherever you listen and at hauntinghistorypodcast.com.
Part 2, The Miranda Project. Sometimes you meet a person and you just click. You're comfortable with them, like you've known them your whole life, and you don't have to pretend to be anyone or anything. Alexandra Ardanetto. Friendship is born at the moment when one person says to another, "What, you too? I thought I was the only one." C.S. Lewis. If you love something, let it go. If it doesn't come back, hunt it down and kill it. Leonard Lake. Daddy dies. Mommy cries. Baby fries. Charles Ng.
Good evening. It's a Sunday in October. 22nd, 23rd, something like that. Very close to my 38th birthday. And I'm starting this tape without script or without any real organization of what I want to say. But I do feel I need to explain. What I want is an off-the-shelf sex partner. I want to be able to use a woman whenever and however I want. And when I'm tired, or bored, or not interested, I simply want to put her away. Lock her up in a little room. Get her out of my sight, out of my life. A slave. There's no way around it. Primarily a sexual slave, but nonetheless a physical slave as well. And I believe that I can, if I can construct a holding cell, a place where I can put such a woman, a facility that is so stark, so empty, so cold, so quiet, so totally removed from the world, that I can quickly condition a young woman to cooperate with me fully.
Leonard Lake and Charles Ng were an unlikely pair. Lake was a hippie veteran of the Vietnam War, obsessed with pornography, nuclear warfare, and survival techniques. 15 years his junior, Ng was a loner from Hong Kong with a penchant for theft. On their own, they were both troubled, loathsome individuals. But together, they were an evil, deadly combination. They brought out the worst in one another, fed off of one another, and encouraged one another in their cruel intentions. It was only a matter of time before their obscene desires became sadistic realities. Between the years of 1983 and 1985, the deadly duo would be responsible for the murders of between 12 and 25 men, women, and children, the exact number of which is still unknown. Born on October 29, 1945 in San Francisco, California, Leonard Lake's troubled life's path began when he was just 6 years old. His parents had separated less than amicably, and he was sent to live with his maternal grandmother while his mother and younger brother followed Lake's father to Seattle in an attempt to repair the marriage. His mother returned to San Francisco alone a year later, having failed at her attempt to reconcile. She did remarry eventually, but Leonard would never again live with her. He had been traumatized by her abandonment so soon after his father's desertion and wanted to remain in a stable household with his grandparents. His cousin Chester Richardson, 9 years younger, lived just a few blocks from Lake and his grandparents and frequently visited the older boy. According to Richardson, Lake enjoyed chemistry and often performed experiments with acid, dissolving various items and materials for fun. He also had a horde of mice that quickly outgrew his ability to care for them. His solution to the overpopulation of the little creatures was to sell some, give some away, and to kill the rest, dissolving them in the acid he often experimented with, and watching them melt into a viscous green goo. Lake remained cordial with his mother, and supposedly had decent relationships with his sisters, though perhaps even those familial ties were unsavory, as it's been alleged that Lake would take pornographic photos of his sisters and even blackmail them with the inappropriate pictures in return for sexual favors. His affability, however, inappropriate though it was, did not extend to his younger brother Donald, who Lake viewed as a drain on society and a freeloader of taxpayer money. The younger sibling had been involved in an accident when he was a child that left him with a brain injury, allowing him to receive government assistance. "He'd be better off dead," his sister Janet recalled Leonard once saying. As Lake grew older, his desire to strike out on his own grew as well. Shortly after his 18th birthday, Lake enlisted in the United States Marine Corps. Weapons, firepower, military jargon, guerrilla warfare, survival tactics, camouflage, all of it appealed to Lake. While stationed in North Carolina, he met a young woman named Karen Lee Minersman. The two formed a relationship and eventually married in 1969. Lake served 2 tours of duty in Vietnam as a radar technician, but was given a medical discharge in 1971 due to having a delusional breakdown in Da Nang and ultimately being diagnosed with schizoid personality disorder. Upon his return to civilian life, Lake was enthralled with the hippie lifestyle of San Francisco. His obsessions with women and erotic pleasures were also impassioned, and the book The Collector by John Fowles, written in 1963, served to further influence his dark fantasies. His behavior began to worry his young bride, who was often subjected to physical, mental, and sexual abuse at the hands of her husband. In 1972, once she discovered that Lake was making amateur pornographic films, movies that frequently included sadomasochistic acts, she left the marriage. Now single, Lake played the field, dating various women and embracing the free-loving hippie lifestyle that San Francisco had to offer. Many partners, however, were scared away by his dark erotic fantasies, obsessive desire to photograph them, and his unnerving discussions regarding snuff films. He also became increasingly obsessed with nuclear warfare, survival techniques, and the need to repopulate the Earth after the bombs had destroyed all human life. His obsessions led him to settling in the town of Ukiah, about 2 hours north of San Francisco, where he took classes on animal sciences and butchery at Mendocino College, though he didn't make it past his first semester. He made his home in the hills above Ukiah in a quiet settlement called The Ranch, a self-sustaining hippie commune whose residents respected Mother Earth and prohibited the use of items such as pesticides and firearms, a bylaw that Lake regularly ignored. His ongoing fear of nuclear annihilation began to increase exponentially, which influenced him to construct a survival bunker on his property that was funded mostly by stealing building supplies from other project sites. Many neighbors observed his behavior, and many more thought of him as an unsavory character. He spoke often to men and women alike about his sexual predilections and frequently asked young women to pose nude for him. The best success he found was at local Renaissance fairs, where he would bring a goat with one horn strapped to its head and use that to lure in women to take photographs. He was still obsessed with survival and weaponry as well, and often corresponded with other like-minded individuals through ads placed in magazines such as Soldier of Fortune, which he penned under the name Tom Myers. One such individual, Mark Novak, even visited Lake at the ranch. In the summer of 1980, Lake attended a Renaissance fair in Marin County where he met a young woman named Clara Lynn Blaze, who he took to calling Cricket. Unlike the other woman who had been scared away by Lake's obsessions with nude photos and tawdry sexual escapades, Cricket matched him step for step. Her interests included homemade pornography, hardcore BDSM, and pedophilia.
Let's see, we talked about underage performers, but I've seen some awfully cute looking little 14, 16 year olds that I envy, so I'm going watching them do something interesting.
While Cricket was enamored with her new partner, the other residents of the ranch were not. Their patience with his constant lewd behavior and disrespect for the bylaws came to a head when Lake was eventually caught red-handed stealing building materials. He was then asked to leave the commune. Lake and Cricket left the ranch and ended up in the small town of Philo, where they found a job managing a motel. Life, from the outside, appeared fairly normal for the couple. Inside, however, Lake desired so much more. He and Cricket ended up taking in an 18-year-old girl by the name of Connie Richards on the pretense of employment at the motel. The reality, however, was considerably different. Connie became nothing more than a plaything, a sexual partner for both Lake and his now wife, Cricket, whom he had married on September 13, 1981. Connie stayed with the Lakes for a few months, satisfying their sexual urges and working at the motel, but eventually grew tired of being a sexual object and left, saying goodbye to Leonard, his new bride, and a small yet stocky Asian man who had shown up a few weeks earlier. Mark Novak, who had kept in contact with Lake through a secret post office box, had given Lake's contact information to a fellow Marine by the name of Charles Ng, who was facing court-martial in Hawaii. Some sources claim the two met when Charles Ng answered an ad placed in Soldier of Fortune magazine by Leonard Lake, but either way, the deadly duo formed a friendship that was based on mutual obsessions with weapons and women. Charlie, as Lake preferred to call him, was a troubled young man. He was born in Hong Kong on Christmas Eve of 1960 to wealthy parents. His father was extremely domineering, and Ng was sternly disciplined regularly. He was often in trouble due to his kleptomania and was expelled from various schools before being sent to a private boarding school in England. There, too, he caused trouble and was caught stealing from other students. He was ultimately sent back to Hong Kong, much to the dismay of his parents. With the use of a student visa, Ng moved to the United States in 1979 and studied for only one semester at the College of Notre Dame in Belmont, California. Shortly after his arrival, he was involved in a hit-and-run accident. Rather than face a trial, Ng falsified his birth records and joined the United States Marine Corps, something else he had in common with Lake.
Once there were a few proud men, men of adventure, men of courage, men who knew the meaning of honor. Still are the Marines. We're looking for a few good men.
Less than a year after he joined the Marines, Ng was arrested on charges of theft, this time of explosives and automatic weapons, and faced a court-martial for his actions. When he managed to escape military prison in 1981, he sought out Leonard Lake. The Mendocino County Sheriff's Office, along with the FBI, had been keeping an eye on Lake and his new friend, a known fugitive on the lam from military police, and soon descended upon the duo and raided their dwelling in search of illegal weapons and contraband. They found plenty. Ng was sent back to Hawaii to face court-martial, while Lake jumped bail and began his life as a felon on the run. The chaos of living a life with a fugitive took its toll on Lake's wife Cricket, and she moved to San Bruno while Lake stayed in a mountain cabin owned by her father near Wilseyville, California, in Calaveras County. On November 30, 1982, the couple were officially divorced, though they remained friends and even continued to have a sexual relationship. Ng served 18 months before being paroled, writing and receiving letters and photos from Leonard Lake during his incarceration, and was dishonorably discharged in 1984. After being paroled, Ng made his way back to California and sought refuge with Lake. It's likely that by this time, Lake had already killed two people, his best friend Charles Gunner, whom he had always chastised for being overweight, lazy, and cruel to his wife and daughters, and his younger brother Donald, the younger sibling he viewed as nothing more than a drain on society, both of whom disappeared in 1983. Lake had also started construction on a cinder block building he described as his dungeon. The desired use and actual events that took place within the dungeon were documented in detail with photos and homemade videos. Lake also kept a personal journal, the first entry of which was written on January 1st of 1983. He would write faithfully in that journal for the next 2 years, documenting everything from the mundane to the absolutely horrifying. In 1984, Lake and Ng embarked on a murderous spree that would involve kidnapping, sexual and psychological abuse, torture, and murder. It was called the Miranda Project, named for the main character in Lake's favorite book, John Fowle's 1963 novel, The Collector, in which a social misfit captures a woman named Miranda, who is the object of his affections, and keeps her locked in his basement. She is then forced to abide by a specific set of rules that the captor creates. The cinder block bunker that Lake had constructed housed various weapons, tools, explicit photos of young girls and women, as well as a 6-foot by 3-foot dungeon, hidden by a false wall and furnished only with a wooden cot, a shelf with minimal toiletries, and toilet paper. A list of rules was taped to the wall, similar to that found in the book. Rules. 1. I must always be ready to service my master. I must be clean, brushed, and made up with my cell neat. 2. I must never speak unless spoken to. Unless in bed, I must never look my master in the eye, but keep my eyes downcast. 3. I must never show my disrespect, either verbally or silent. I must never cross my arms or legs in front of my body or clench my fists, and unless eating, must always keep my lips parted. 4. I must be obedient completely and in all things. I must obey immediately and without question or comment. 5. I must always be quiet when locked in my cell. 6. I must remember and obey any additional rules told to me. I must understand that any disobedience, any pain, trouble, or annoyance caused by me to my master will be grounds for punishment. The dungeon was also equipped with a one-way mirror and video equipment meant for constant observation and voyeurism. In the 11 months between July of 1984 and June of 1985, Lake and Ng kidnapped, humiliated, and tortured at least 11 men, women, and children. Their typical modus operandi was to answer an ad placed in a newspaper, often as a response to items for sale. The Dubs family, Harvey and his wife Deborah, had placed such an ad, listing Harvey's professional video equipment for rent.
Police are saying tonight that they need your help in the search for a San Francisco family that vanished 3 weeks ago. Harvey and Deborah Dubs were last seen on the evening of July 26th. The next day, the Dubs and their 18-month-old son disappeared. Police have several theories about the case.
And they all are plausible. Every one of them is possible in this case, and yet every one of them doesn't quite hold water. Everything we seem to come up with has a slight contradiction to it. It doesn't quite make sense. That's the mystery of this case.
Right now, police are looking for several people who used one of Mrs. Dubs' credit cards on the peninsula. Authorities are looking for a Chinese man in his late 20s, a tall, heavyset Caucasian man in his 30s, and a heavyset Caucasian woman. If you think you know any of these people, San Francisco police would like for you to give them a call. There is a $10,000 reward for information leading to a conviction in the case.
On July 25th, 1984, Leonard Lake and Charles Ng answered that ad. As Harvey, Deborah, and their 16-month-old son, Sean, finished dinner, Lake and Ng entered their home, feigned interest in the equipment, and then attacked. Harvey was killed. 16-month-old Sean was killed as well. It was the deadly duo's routine to get rid of the men, and on at least 2 occasions, the children first. Deborah was mercilessly tortured, defiled, and ultimately murdered, as she was seen on a home video being assaulted so viciously that it's likely she wouldn't have survived. Harvey's video equipment was taken back to Lake's cabin to further document their horrific acts.
If you go along with this, cooperate with this, we'll be as nice as we can to you within the limits of keeping you prisoner. If you don't go along with this, we'll probably take you into the bed, tie you down, rape you, shoot you, and bury you. So, my lady, time's up. Make your choice.
Sir, I cannot be available.
Tell me what you're here.
Why are you here? We'll keep you busy. You'll wash for us, you'll clean for us, cook for us, you'll cook for us. That's your choice in a nutshell. It's not much of a choice. Unless you've got death wish.
Yeah, I don't care.
In April of 1985, 18-year-old Kathy Allen disappeared from her job at a grocery store after receiving a phone call that her boyfriend Mike had been shot. It wasn't true, however. It was a ruse set up by Leonard Lake and Charles Ng, who had met Kathy's boyfriend when they were cellmates in prison, for the purpose of kidnapping and torturing the young woman.
If it ever arises again, if there's any circumstance whatsoever that leads me to think that you're even attempting to make noise, it's immaterial as to whether I hear you or anyone else hears you. You will be whipped very severely. And tell me you understand.
I understand.
I'm having a little war within myself between what I want to do and what we might call the decent thing to do. And for the moment, the decent thing to do is me. So, rest. Okay, I just want you to know that I'm giving this stuff to you under protest. Not that you care, mind you.
Kathy's horrendous ordeal is captured on video, documenting the torture and humiliation she endured before ultimately, perhaps mercifully, being killed. In May of 1985, Lake's closest neighbors, Lonnie Bond, his fiancée, Brenda O'Connor, their young son Lonnie Jr., and family friend Robin Stapley disappeared. The men and child were killed, but not before being forced to watch Brenda as she was forcefully stripped, placed in leg irons, and assaulted.
Don't cut me, bro.
Nothing is yours now. You get took the house.
Life is so hard. It's like sick.
Suffer.
I'm gonna pass out of intimate light or something.
Well, you can pass out, but we won't wake you up.
Brenda, I have a lot of animosity against you, and I would just as soon start you out with a nice firm whipping right now to make you believe how serious we are.
Why are you doing this? She asks in a video of the attack. Where's my baby? Ying tells her, you can cry and stuff, like the rest of them, but it won't do any good. We're pretty cold-hearted.
Your baby is going to be taken away. Excuse me.
I'm going to be taken away.
There's a family down in Fresno that doesn't have a baby.
You're not taking my baby.
But
the
baby's dead, right?
I mean, they got one now. That's my baby.
Your baby is sound asleep, like a rock. We don't like you, but I'd like me to put it in writing?
It's done. Just take it, whatever we tell you.
These young women, and likely many more, were kidnapped and tortured for days, perhaps even weeks, before being discarded or dying from their injuries. Ying would later brag to a cellmate that he would torture and disfigure women with power drills, pliers, and vices. Their knuckles would be crushed with the vice grips, attachments would be put on the drills and placed in the vaginas and anuses of the captives, and the pliers would be used to rip off their nipples. The goal of the perpetrators was to indulge in their fantasies of owning a sex slave, a woman completely broken down and submissive to the whims of her captors. To reach their goal, however, many men and even some children were also killed along the way. Their deaths provided money, identities, and even vehicles for the demented duo. While driving one of these stolen vehicles in the summer of 1985, their entire world came crumbling down. Ying's kleptomania would be the deadly duo's downfall. On June 2, 1985, at South City Lumber in San Francisco, California, a report of a shoplifter was called into the police. Apparently in need of a new torture device, Charles Ying gave in to his kleptomaniac needs and attempted to steal a table vise. When approached by staff, Ying tossed the vise into the trunk of the vehicle he and Lake were traveling in and took off on foot. Lake, attempting to quell what he called a misunderstanding, offered to pay for the item, but ultimately was taken into police custody when a firearm with an illegal silencer was found in the vehicle. Lake was in possession of an ID with the name of Robin Stapley and a vehicle registered to a Paul Cosner. The jig was up. Lake had decided long ago that he would never face the consequences of his horrific actions. He made sure of it by sewing cyanide pills into the lining of his clothing. At the station, while being interrogated, Lake asked for some water and a pad of paper. He wrote a quick note to Cricket, apologizing, and then swallowed the pill. He was rushed to the hospital, convulsing and foaming at the mouth, and he died days later. Further investigation into Lake showed that the car he was driving had been stolen, and the owner had been missing for some months. The driver's license Lake was carrying also belonged to another missing person. On the vehicle's floorboard, a utility bill in Cricket's name was found. Police contacted her and she was questioned, ultimately leading authorities to her family's Wilseyville cabin in the woods. On June 5, 1985, the cabin was searched and detectives were not prepared for what awaited them.
Up until this point, we've really relied on our imaginations to visualize this story. But today we have pictures, pictures that will probably leave many people with an everlasting image of the horror that occurred at the end of this road.
These are some of the bone fragments that have been found, and investigators say there are countless fragments just like those scattered over a third of an acre here. The California Conservation Corps has been recruited to pick up the bones. Most of them worked on their hands and knees, raking the ground with their fingers. Investigators came up with 10 pounds of bones.
The local coroner says 5 bodies have been found here so far. The Calaveras County Sheriff once told me, though, he believes there are as many as 20 victims, though, buried on the property.
In the bedroom, the bed had holes drilled into the post and appeared like it was meant to restrain someone. Detectives also noticed equipment that a keen investigator recognized as being similar to the missing video equipment from the Dubs case. Further investigation unearthed 11 bodies that were buried on the land, along with bone fragments of a possible 12th victim. An additional 45 pounds of charred bones were also uncovered, leaving detectives to surmise that many of the victims were chopped up and burned after being killed. 2 5-gallon drums containing the IDs of at least 25 people were also unearthed, as well as videos and journals detailing the vicious duo's abhorrent attacks. 6 men, 3 women, and 2 babies were positively identified. Charles Gunner's body was eventually found on the property 15 years after his disappearance. Ng fled to Calgary, Alberta, Canada, but still couldn't keep himself out of trouble. His kleptomania kicked in, and on July 6, 1985, while attempting to steal a can of salmon, a store detective approached him. A scuffle ensued, and Ng, carrying a concealed weapon, shot the security guard in the hand. He was taken to jail where he served 4.5 years for shoplifting and attempted murder. The United States authorities had to wait until he served out his Canadian sentence before they could begin the extradition process. He was eventually sent back to the States to face murder charges in 1991, after trying to manipulate the system in order to stay in Canada longer by firing his lawyers and claiming that being sent back to California would ultimately mean his death. It took 7 years to eventually bring Ng to trial. With so much evidence, the case files weighed almost 2 tons. Both the prosecution and the defense needed time to build their cases. On October 26, 1998, Ng's trial finally began. Leonard Lake had been dead for 13 years. Ng tried to play down his involvement and put most of the actual killings on Lake, who couldn't be punished from 6 feet underground. Charles Ng's parents flew in from Hong Kong to defend their son's character, with his mother blaming the behavior on the vicious beatings he had endured as a child at the hands of his own father, who sat meekly beside her. Prosecutors weren't fooled by the pleas of Ng nor his family, and soon introduced evidence that included cartoon drawings by Ng from prison. Most of these drawings depicted women and children being tortured. Ng admitted he drew most of the cartoons while awaiting extradition in a Canadian prison. "I can explain," Ng said repeatedly when faced with the evidence. He said the drawings didn't reflect actual events, but were over-the-top and admittedly tasteless jokes. "This was my way of ridiculing charges that I had no way to defend at the time," Ng said. One drawing showed a mother holding a baby on a plate with the caption, "Daddy dies, Mommy cries, Baby fries." When asked what the baby was doing in the drawing, Ng said it was a microwave baby. He said he drew the cartoon after hearing what he proclaimed to be wild prison rumors that he and Lake had microwaved babies. Another drawing, headed with the caption, "Lake's Baby Die School," showed Ng wildly swinging a baby in a pillowcase. Lake is also shown, prepared to dump 2 babies into a barrel of water. Due to various appeals, delays, and the media circus surrounding the case, the trial of Charles Ng would cost over $10 million and would be one of the most expensive in California history.
As the Charles Ng trial finally gets underway.
The 37-year-old Ng allegedly tortured and killed a dozen people in a cabin in the Sierra Nevadas in the 1980s. During opening statements, defense attorneys told jurors it was Ng's friend Leonard Lake that committed the crimes, but the prosecution played graphic videotapes seized at Ng's apartment, including one showing a man who appeared to be the defendant cutting away the shirt and bra of a victim, Kathleen Allen. The pictures are very disturbing, to say the least. Prosecutors then described in detail how the victims were murdered.
Some of the images shown in court today are quite disturbing. Ng's trial began today in Orange County with prosecutors playing a videotape of Ng apparently cutting off the blouse of one of the 12 alleged victims. Prosecutors then went on to describe the way the victims were killed, while the defense placed the blame on Ng's accomplice, Leonard Lake.
That they each showed gunshot wounds, that after each of them, the hands were bound behind the back.
Now, the defense in this case is really simple. And that is that Leonard Lake had a motive for murder. And that motive was grounded in a deep-seated hatred of women.
Lake committed suicide when he was captured in 1985. Ng fled and was later caught in Canada. Ng maintains he's innocent.
For those who knew the victims of the alleged killers, the trail marks the beginning of the end.
Harvey Dubs, his wife Deborah, and their young son Sean disappeared from their San Francisco home July 25th, 1984. victims of what prosecutors say was a sexual thrill-killing spree. Dubs was a graphic artist and editor at Video West, an independent production company. Friend and co-worker Lee Callister was to meet Dubs that day. He was shocked to hear what had happened.
You know, as someone who was close to me had never been a victim, certainly not in anything as bizarre as this.
Callister believes Dubs may have met his captors and killers through an ad he placed to sell some video equipment.
Harvey was from New York, and I think it's kind of ironic, actually, that he got sucked into this because he was a very careful person. He was paranoid about people.
Authorities say Leonard Lake and Charles Ng are the men responsible for the kidnapping, torture, and murder of 12 victims that horrified the nation in 1984 and 85. Investigators call this estate in Calaveras County the killing fields. Here they found more than 40 pounds of human bone fragments, sheds where victims were allegedly held, and Harvey Dubs' video equipment. Police caught Ng and Lake in June of 1985 allegedly trying to steal from a South San Francisco store. Lake killed himself while in police custody by swallowing a cyanide pill. Ng fled and was captured in Canada. It took 6 years to get him returned to California to stand trial. In another 7 years of delays, Ng has gone through 3 judges, a change of venue, and 8 attorneys.
I mean, I feel cheated. I feel cheated that Leonard Lake immediately popped a cyanide pill and took the easy way out. And I feel cheated that Ng has run off to Canada. And, you know, like I say, I'm particularly annoyed, angry that he's managed to play the game for so long. And he certainly deserves, if anyone deserves the death penalty, I would think he does.
Now, Ng has always maintained his innocence in this case. Legal experts predict there is bound to be an appeal, so the case could drag out even longer.
Ng faced 12 counts of murder and was found guilty of 11. In February of 1999, he was sentenced to death.
We, the jury in the above-entitled case, find the defendant, Charles Cheetat Ng, guilty of the murder of Harvey Dubs, as charged in count 3. We further find the murder to be of the first degree. We, the jury in the above-entitled case, find the defendant, Charles Cheetat Ng, guilty of the murder of Michael Carroll, as charged in count 7.
In exchange for her testimony and leading police to incriminating evidence in the Ng trial, Clara Lynn Cricket Blaze was given full immunity. She has since changed her name to Lynn Kessler and is still living somewhere in California. Like Janine Clark in our first case, she got off easy when she threw her lover under the bus. The case of Leonard Lake and Charles Ng has always fascinated me. One man living out a dark fantasy straight out of the pages of a novel, the other obsessed with death and violence and along for the ride. While in death, Leonard Lake may have taken the coward's way out, Ng still sits awaiting punishment on death row in San Quentin, where he has had years upon years to reflect on his crimes and to dream of once again returning to his killing fields, the bunker of death, and to continue the search for a perfect sex slave. Thanks for joining us for the penultimate episode of True Crime Horror Story Season 1. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode, the Season 1 wrap-up. Suggested movies similar to today's cases? For The Miranda Project, The Poughkeepsie Tapes, a 2007 horror movie directed by John Eric Dowdle, and a suggested novel, The Collector, by John Fowles. And for Grotesque, a suggested tourist attraction, The Museum of Death in Los Angeles, California, that features the notorious Glover and Clark photographs, as well as plenty of murderabilia, and is a must-visit for any true crime fanatic. If you like what you hear here on True Crime Horror Story, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. You can also think about joining our Patreon at www.patreon.com/truecrimehs, and then stay tuned after this show on Patreon for the True Crime Horror Story After Show with Dom and JD, as well as exclusive bonus episodes available only on Patreon. This episode features additional research and writing by MR, music by Mechanical Ghost, and artwork by Nuclear Heat Graphics. Has violent crime impacted you or someone close to you? Send us your story at truecrimehorrorstory@gmail.com. True Crime Horror Story. Sometimes truth is more brutal than fiction. Here on True Crime Horror Story, we talk about some of the most shocking cases in American history. But we always give the listener closure at the end of the episodes when these killers are brought to justice one way or another. Unfortunately, the families of some victims of violent crime don't get that closure. Experts estimate that there are hundreds of thousands of untested rape kits in police and crime lab storage facilities throughout the country. There is no comprehensive national data on the nature and scope of the rape kit backlog. In the Backlog is an initiative to shine a light on the backlog of untested rape kits throughout the United States. Their goal is to end this injustice by conducting groundbreaking research identifying the extent of the nation's backlog and best practices for eliminating it, expanding the national dialogue on rape kit testing through increased public awareness, engaging communities and government agencies and officials, and advocating for comprehensive rape kit reform legislation and policies at the local, state, and federal levels. We here at True Crime Horror Story urge you to learn more about the backlog, where it exists, and why it matters, and to take action and support efforts to test rape kits. Your support can help send the message that rape must be taken seriously and every victim deserves closure. EndTheBacklog.org.